One of the most anticipated clinical trial presentations in breast cancer of the past couple of years was data from a phase 3 trial in metastatic triple-negative breast cancer of chemotherapy alone or with the so-called PARP inhibitor Iniparib. I met with the PI of this historic study, Dr. Joyce O'Shaughnessy, and she began discussing the background of the complex and disappointing trial data she presented at ASCO.
We were very excited about Iniparib because it does inhibit the PARP enzyme in a cell-free suspension. Just if you just take the PARP enzyme in isolation, Iniparib is a PARP inhibitor, and there's really excellent preclinical work showing this concept of synthetic lethality, meaning if your BRCA1 or BRCA2 doesn't work correctly, the cell is really reliant on this PARP for its DNA repair. And so if you hit the cell with DNA-damaging chemotherapy like platinum, and then you inhibit PARP, it dies very, very well because there's no way to repair that DNA. So the whole concept of PARP inhibitors was and still is a very exciting concept, you know, for the right cancer where they really cannot repair those double-strand breaks on their own. So they're very reliant on the PARP. So as you know, Neil, we had done a phase 2 trial in triple-negative breast cancer because there's a lot of data that at least a portion of the triple-negatives really are like BRCA1-related cancers. They really have this substantial defect in their ability to repair double-strand breaks. And, you know, the way that works is, for example, when you hit a cancer cell with platinum, it causes a single-strand break. But if the cells are rapidly dividing, those single-strand breaks are converted into double-strand breaks, and now the cell's in hot water because it can't repair it, and then it's reliant on this PARP. And so there's a lot of parallels between certain of the triple-negatives and BRCA1-related breast cancers. So we thought that the best place to test the concept of a PARP inhibitor in breast cancer was in the triple negative subset. Now, we didn't really have a way to select for those triple negatives that really have that problem with homologous recombination, the double-strand DNA repair. So we went into all-comer triple negatives in a randomized phase 2, and we chose gemcitabine carboplatin because they both are DNA-damaging agents leading to single-strand breaks, which get converted to double-strand in a rapidly proliferative cancer, which triple-negative is. And as you know, it was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 123 patients that there was a large improvement in survival, progression-free survival, response rates, and clinical benefit rates, even though 50% of patients who received the gemcarbo alone did cross over to get more gemcarbo plus Iniparib at the time of disease progression. So that was an extremely encouraging result, albeit just a randomized phase 2. Then, of course, you want to go and do your phase 3. And so, of course, we picked the exact same population. And we went ahead and did the big randomized phase 3. It turned out there were 520 patients enrolled on study, much, much larger trial, explosive recruitment, with everybody really coming on, you know, as soon as they recur off of adjuvant ACT. They don't have to be off ACT a year. They could go right on, et cetera. And, you know, same randomization. And now, at the time of the primary analysis, 96% of patients who had received the GC and had progressed, 96% of those women had crossed over to get more gemcitabine carboplatin plus the Iniparib, so a higher rate of crossover. And much to our disappointment, we did not see the improvement in progression-free and overall survival. Now, interestingly, it was a co-primary endpoint, which means that if you had won on either progression for your overall survival, the study would be positive, but you have to lower down your p-value. You have to split that p-value of 0.05 into two buckets. And so the p-value you had to hit on the progression-free survival was actually 0.01. So the p-value on the progression-free survival was 0.027. So significant by standard criteria, but not by the pre-specified criteria in the protocol. And we didn't see an improvement in response rates either. So a very, very disappointing result. One other thing that's very important to mention is that in the meantime, it's become clear that though Iniparib does inhibit PARP as a protein, that at the physiologically achievable concentrations in humans with the current dose that we give of Iniparib, we are not inhibiting PARP. So Iniparib actually is not a PARP inhibitor when it comes to women and the triple negative breast cancers.
Can you just clarify that a little bit? Because you had referred me to this poster that was presented, I think, in April in AACR that specifically looked into it. Can you talk about what they found, what PARP 1, 2, 5, and 6 and telomeres are?
Yes. That was a really interesting piece of work. And the first author is GJI, and the last author is Jim Doroshow from the NCI. What they did was they took the olaparib and the veliparib, which are PARP inhibitors, definitely, and the inhibrib, and they used a MX1 triple negative breast cancer cell line. And fortunately, at the physiologically achievable drug concentrations, they used these agents as single agents on these cell lines and did see evidence of DNA damage, double strand breaks with all three of them. And the readout for that is these foci called gamma H2AX. So you do see that inhibrib does indeed cause DNA damage. However, when they then did gene expression profiling on the cell lines to see what was actually being inhibited, what was really changing compared to the baseline versus after the treatment, they found out that definitely the veliparib and olaparib inhibited PARP1, true PARP inhibitors, where it was also clear to them that inhibrib was not at those physiologic concentrations. But interestingly, when they said, well, what is inhibrib hitting? What they found was that it was interfering with maintenance of the telomeres. And the telomeres are the ends of the chromosomes. And they really have to be maintained by a whole host of enzymes to keep those chromosomes able to continue to divide and have the cell not die. So the telomeres are extremely important to these very, very rapidly growing cells. And when you inhibit the telomere pathway, you get a crushing amount of DNA damage and the cell has a necrotic-like cell death. They had mentioned, Neil, PARP 5 and 6 in the abstract that they submitted to the AACR 2011. PARP 5 and 6 are tank raises that are definitely involved in maintenance of the telomere pathway. However, I've been told, and I've read it myself, that if you look at the actual poster that was brought to the AACR by the group, they actually didn't really focus on the PARP 5 and 6, so I assume they have more work to do there. They were talking about the telomere pathway, the signature, the gene profiling signature for the telomere pathway more generally. So basically, it's still putting us in the neighborhood of inhibrib inhibiting the cell's desperate attempt to keep its chromosomes and have some semblance of genomic stability in the face of highly genetically unstable cells causing DNA damage, significant DNA damage, and really stressing the cell at a vulnerable point. So I still think that another very, very important part of the phase 3 is patient selection. It's possible, given that the phase 2 is so small, that doctors were enrolling patients on the phase 2 whom they thought might benefit from GemCarbo. You know, docs have a very good nose, and they may have been thinking, well, gee, I have a feel for who's going to benefit from GemCarbo, so I'm going to put those patients on because, you know, those are the patients that may benefit from DNA-damaging strategies like GemCarbo, and then if inhibrib is going to enhance that effect. And so at the phase 3 level, because inhibrib looked so promising, you get a much broader population. And a tremendous amount of work is ongoing, Neil, to look for patient populations between the phase 2 and the phase 3. And I showed this interesting slide at ASCO. I know you were very interested in it, where very preliminary work. It's not the final subtyping answer, but we did utilize the original Peru and Sorley gene set to look at the basal-like triple negative breast cancers, the Claudin low triple negative breast cancers, the luminal B triple negative breast cancers, the HER2 enriched. So even though they're ER negative and even though they're HER2 negative, they can still have an intrinsic subtype that puts them into the luminal category, either the luminal B aggressive ones or the HER2 enriched, even though they're not HER2 amplified. And we saw a tremendous variability in the subtypes in the phase 3. And so an obvious hypothesis is, well, you know, if you looked at the basal-like breast cancers where we really think the homologous recombination defect is, or the genomic instability there, you know, if the inhibrib is causing double-strand breaks and stressing that cell. So That's the hope. That's the hope that we will be able to identify a subtype of the triple negative's very, very heterogeneous breast cancer that ANIPRIB may still benefit in combination with the GemCarbo. And so by the end of the year, we plan to have an answer to that question.
Yeah, when I saw that slide go up there, my eyes just got wide, you know, because all the other stuff was just kind of sort of depressing or, you know, what we kind of were expecting based on that press release that came out. But looking at that, it was just amazing to see, you know, who actually ended up being in a triple negative study. And then the other slide that I think sort of tied into it in the discussion, Lisa Carey showed data was kind of almost the reverse, looking at the different subtypes and seeing what the ER subsets were. And again, a lot of heterogeneity, which I guess that's sort of basic. It had been published before, but I didn't realize that, for example, within the so-called, let's say, quote, basal subset genomically, there are people who have ER-positive disease, correct?
That's correct.
I mean, not that many, but some, and HER2-positive, and I don't know. It was just, you know, really kind of striking to think about what's really going on. Just sort of taking a step back, you know, I think oncologists are familiar with the mathematics involved in terms of HER2 and trastuzumab, the idea that I think there have been some modeling done that if we had used, for example, trastuzumab in all the patients instead of just the 20% that are HER2 positive, we wouldn't have seen any benefit. If, in fact, let's just say there are 20% of breast cancer or 20% of triple negative, I guess, that would be very sensitive to or outcome very much improved with enaprib, but we didn't know what that 20% was, would that be compatible with what we've seen? And do you think that's what's going on, or do you think it was just the phase two was lucky?
I think there may well be a subset, Neil, and I think that really is reflected in the commentary we heard from Lisa Carey and her discussion.
Right.
We've heard subsequently from folks like Eric Weiner, et cetera, that have had a chance to really delve into the data. And I say that because even with the PFS having a p-value that was close to conventionally, or it was conventionally positive, and when you do the multivariate analysis that was called for in the protocol, all pre-specified, and you adjust for slight imbalances and, you know, disease-free interval and, you know, sites of disease, visceral and, you know, et cetera, you do get a signal there. You get, actually, your survival hazard ratios go down around 0.65. And it's looking a little bit closer to the phase two. So slight imbalances in the arms can definitely skew things a bit. We saw a signal even before the multivariate analysis. We saw a signal in the second, third line patients where actually the data looked very good in the second, third line, did not look good in the first line. Again, here's a hypothesis, that, you know, first line, we know that these patients got treated with a taxane and 30% of them got bevacizumab. And then they go on to a platinum-based regimen, GemCarbo, second, third line. And so the question is, you know, are you killing off cells with bevacizumab and paclitaxel that are more of the mesenchymal variety, because neither of those are DNA damaging agents, of course, and you're letting grow out now some subclones that are more genomically unstable, susceptible to DNA damaging agents. And so is that why you might see a signal in the second, third line? You know, we don't know. So the bottom line is, you know, there was a signal there. So it is entirely possible that what's buried in that signal is a subpopulation of patients, and you're treating all comers. And here we are patting ourselves on the back, focusing on triple negative breast cancer. It's only 15-20% of breast cancers. We're really focusing down in there rather than do the kitchen sink type clinical trial. And now it turns out, well, it may only be a subset of the triple negatives. And that's, everybody agrees, that's what we must find out. These cancers can be as different as day and night. And we need to sort out the molecular characteristics of these cancers and understand sensitivity and resistance patterns of regular treatments, as well as bevacizumab and as well as ANIPRIB. So yes, Neil, we could, there looks like there's a signal there. It's just maybe that it's not large enough in a mixed population of patients to be able to really make it significant.
So let's talk about the cases you brought, beginning with your 27-year-old woman.
She's currently getting treated as we speak, and she is very young. She is 27 years old. And she engaged to be married, and she noted a mass in the upper outer quadrant of her left breast. Mammogram was negative, but ultrasound showed a 1 by 1.5 centimeter mass, not very large.
Family history?
No family history. No family history.
Did you test her for BRCA or offer it?
Yes. She has been tested for BRCA, and she is negative for BRCA1 and 2. And she went on to lumpectomy and had a successful lumpectomy, clear margins, sentinel lymph node negative. Now, her breast cancer was read as grade 1, and it's small, 1 by 1.5 centimeters, no LVI, ERPR strongly positive, and a Ki-67 that was only in the 10 to 15% range, which is quite low, not the lowest, you know, not under 10%, but 10 to 15 is really pretty low. It's being called grade 1 on both the original biopsy and on the lumpectomy, and HER2 like zero, you know, no hint of HER2. So I was really hoping that she'd be somebody that I didn't need to give chemotherapy to. I'll talk about what I recommended towards general therapy, you know, which is a controversial point in and of itself. But I thought that with endocrine therapy that was good and maybe stepped up a notch, you know, to make sure we got her really excellent benefit, et cetera, but didn't get in the way of her childbearing, et cetera, that I thought maybe she'd be somebody we wouldn't need chemo on. Because, you know, chemotherapy for a slower growing grade one, you know, if it helps somebody at all, we'd wonder if it's through a ovarian suppression mechanism as opposed to a direct cytotoxic. But in my practice, if I'm going to recommend against chemotherapy in a population whom we've traditionally given chemotherapy to, and the Oxford Overview analysis tells us there's big benefit, i.e. premenopausal or perimenopausal ER-positive breast cancer, you know, even up to age 59, 50 to 59, big benefit there from chemotherapy, even in ER-positive patients. If I'm going to recommend against chemotherapy, I actually want the recurrence score to be sure that biologically there's not more going on in that cancer, that the data with the recurrence score would predict there may be chemotherapy benefit. So we always agree in advance, you know, because there's no sense sending it unless you've got a plan and the patient is agreeable to the plan. So I said to her that if it came back low, under 18, that I would recommend endocrine therapy alone. If it came back in the middle, that we would discuss, you know, kind of exactly what we know and don't know. But that generally speaking, if it came back definite, I don't mean necessarily, you know, 19, 1 point into the intermediate, but if it came back, you know, higher intermediate, that I was going to recommend 4 cycles of the TC, the docetaxel cyclophosphamide. But I thought it was going to come back low. I really did. Well, it came back at 24. The recurrence score came back at 24. And that this just illustrates, you know, you don't want to do it unless you're prepared to act on it. So she and I had had the conversation. So I said to her, I don't know exactly. Well, actually, interestingly, Neil, and I find this quite a bit, the ER and the PR were read as close to 100% with the IHC. They weren't that strongly positive on the recurrence score. And that's very highly quantitative way, as you know, in terms of measuring the amount of ER and PR. And as I've heard Soon Paik say on many occasions, with the estrogen receptor, the development of the antibody that we use for ER on purpose, it was built to saturate and read out 100% of the ER at moderate levels of ER because the goal was not to miss the low-level expression of the ER. So it's very, very, very sensitive at picking up, you know, 1%, 2% of ER. But by the time you're getting to 50, 60% of cells positive, it's reading out as 100%. So you cannot tell the difference, actually, between something that's 100% positive and something that's, you know, more moderately positive. So she was not that strongly ERPR positive. I wish they would add a Ki-67 onto the recurrence score.
Well, they do measure proliferation, but they don't report it individually.
Right.
Right. So it's
right,
in there.
Exactly.
It's just you can't dissect it out.
And just a nuance on this, Neil, you know, we don't know. The truth is we don't know whether chemotherapy is going to be of benefit to somebody with an intermediate recurrence score. We just don't know. And obviously that's the point of the TAILOR-X trial. But it's interesting because you can be higher on the recurrence score for a number of different reasons. It can either be because your proliferation is higher, in which case chemotherapy might benefit you. However, it could also be because some of the more, again, we'll use the word mesenchymal, the more invasive markers, you know, your LVI and some of your macrophage markers that are bringing those nasty cytokines in there. Well, yeah, you can have a little higher risk, Neil, but that doesn't mean you're going to benefit from chemotherapy, you know. So It'd be interesting, and I know they'll sort this all out, you know, at the end of the day with the Taylor X trial. They just don't have enough numbers right now to sort that out. But at any rate, because with this being called a grade one cancer and not very fast growing in this patient, but I felt we were kind of stuck when she came back with a recurrence score of 24. And I explained to her that we don't really know, but at the end of the day, she's only 27 years old. So I did recommend the four cycles of TC. She is using the Penguin Cold Cap. She's not losing her hair, which is terrific. And so she's doing exceptionally well. She's just gotten her fourth cycle. And then, you know, the controversy is, what about endocrine therapy in such a patient? She is going to want to become pregnant over the next year or so. And I said to her, well, I'm recommending to you tamoxifen in combination with an LHRH agonist for a couple of years. And then that way you've got an excellent endocrine therapy. And then stopping the endocrine therapy, getting pregnant, having a child, going maybe back on it. We just really don't know how effective tamoxifen is in the, what I call the very young, you know, those under 35. We just don't have a lot of data.
So final question about this case. If her oncotype had come back high, would you still have given her TC?
It's interesting. I probably would have, because we're balancing the recurrence score high results with the standard pathological variables. And what we know from the NSABP-B20 study was that the CMF was extremely effective in the high recurrence score patients. And I think that four cycles of TC being superior to AC, which is the same as CMF, still seems like reasonable therapy to me. So I probably wouldn't, in her particular case, Neil, I don't think I would have changed. Other patients maybe that had node-positive disease, for example, if they had come back with a high recurrence score, there I would probably have to sit down and kind of rethink. Four would probably be too short, frankly, for a node positive. But for a small node negative, I don't think I would have changed in her particular case.
Interesting. How about your next case?
Oh, I like this case. I'm really happy to have the opportunity to tell you about this one. Very, very interesting woman on several levels. She is now about early 60s. And I met her about almost 10 years ago now, when she presented with a locally advanced left breast cancer that was ERPR positive. So she was postmenopausal. I think she had been on HRT, early 50s, and it was HER2 negative. And Ki-67 sort of in the 30% range, locally advanced large cancer, and unfortunately, at presentation, she was found to have bone metastases. She was being treated by a different physician at that time, and she received one cycle of AC before they had the results of the bone scan back, and, you know, to get her some preoperative therapy. And then the bone scan came back, and she had metastatic disease. So she came to me at that time for a second opinion, and I recommended we treat her with letrozole and IV bisphosphonate, which she received, and she did great on it. I believe she got, you know, a good 2-3 years there. She had nice cytoreduction of the breast mass. She went to mastectomy. And I don't believe she got radiation therapy. I don't believe so. And she just did great. Then when her disease progressed, it progressed in bone and liver, as is so often the case. And a rebiopsy showed still ER positive. The PR is now gone in the liver, so often the case. Ki-67 now 30 to 50%, a little faster growing. So we had a clinical trial going on at that time, which Joanne Blum has subsequently published in JCO, of weekly paclitaxel, day one, day eight, at 80 per meter, along with capecitabine. And the capecitabine is 825 milligrams per meter squared, BID 14.7.
I always liked that approach.
Oh, it's so well tolerated.
That goes back a long way, right?
Oh, yeah. And it's my go-to treatment today, Neil, for the more rapidly growing, documented still to be ER positive metastatic breast cancer, particularly bone only, liver only, or bone liver. But it's faster growing. It's not your indolent patient, you know, that is going to go on to serial hormones, okay? This is your faster growing ER positive. So
I remember Joanne started coming out with that not long after you had reported the docetaxel capecitabine, which was very effective, but, you know, kind of toxic.
Exactly, exactly. And this weekly paclitaxel capecitabine is very well tolerated, very, very much so. And, you know, we found out the dose. It's total daily dose of 1650 per meter 14.7. So, you know, it's not anywhere near the labeled dose. Works great. And the response rate's 52%. But in this kind of luminal B, faster growing ER positive breast cancer, it is magic. And she is one of two others just like her, Neil, that I can tell the exact story from the same clinical trial. And interestingly, the biology is identical. Okay. So she gets a CR in her liver and bones.
Can I just ask why you didn't think, or did you think about, or maybe even try another hormone first?
I think it was because she ended up having moderate volume liver disease, Neil. Although she was asymptomatic, one could easily have gone on to fulvestrant, exemestane at that time, absolutely, you know, in an asymptomatic woman. I think it was the concern about the liver disease at that time. So she had a CR, and she had, I can't remember, 6 or 8 cycles of the both drugs together.
How did she do tolerating-wise?
Great. You know, she lost her hair, of course, but other than that, she did great. Her side effect was from the capecitabine, ended up being diarrhea. She had no hand-foot syndrome at all, no mucositis. So we stopped the taxane after 6 or 8 cycles when she had gotten a CR. Neil, she had 5 years
Wow.
of capecitabine, and I have 2 women exactly like her with bone liver. Actually, one, to be precise, was liver only. The other one was bone liver. And I'm going to come back and talk about them in contrast to this patient here. So she did 5 years. 5 years on the capecitabine alone. Marvelous quality of life. Marvelous. You know, some diarrhea. So we had to make some changes in the schedule. And I think over time, we got down to 10 days on, week off, rather than 14-7. But at any rate, she did great. So then when her disease progressed, Neil, it progressed in the liver. And as happened to another patient who was exactly on the identical trajectory as this patient we're talking about here, I tried every hormone we have and every chemotherapy we have and bevacizumab, and I could not get this patient who had been very sensitive to letrozole and to taxane and to capecitabine, I could not get her into a durable response. Best she got from anything was some stable disease because she's got an informative CA2729. It was very depressing because we went from one thing to another. I tried everything. She got like stable disease with estradiol, 2 milligrams TID. She got stable disease for 3 or 4 months. I couldn't get her a good response. So then what happened, Neil, and she had a great performance status. I mean, and she's the life of the party. This great gal has really got a spirit. Unfortunately, the liver disease kept progressing, and she came in. She started developing ascites and then the lower extremity edema, and the albumin's falling, and now we're into anasarca. And one day, and we're trying. She comes in, and this was about February of this year, and she now has a bilirubin of 3.8. And she's got a significant ascites, and she's lower extremity edema big time. You know, she's laying down on the exam table when you come in, and she's picked up 45 pounds of water weight from low albumin. And she says, well, what else do you have for me? Well, as you know, eribulin was approved by the FDA late last year. And we have to be so careful in the setting of elevated liver function. But if you read the package label insert on the eribulin, you'll see that up to a child PUA category, you're allowed to give some eribulin at lower dose. And as I've looked into that, you know, that's up to a bilirubin in the 2 to 3 range with very, very cautious dosing. So unlike, you know, the taxanes, exabebalone, et cetera, vinorelbine, where we don't go near a patient with an elevated bilirubin, this I felt, you know, the package insert and the safety experience at a lower dose was helpful. So I said, we're going to give you a 75% dose, the 1.1 milligrams per meter squared, day one only, not day 8, and see how it goes. And she did end up in the hospital, Neil. She had significant grade 3 mucositis, and she had significant neutropenia. She was not febrile, but she was dehydrated. But she wasn't really, you know, that sick, you know, from the point of view of sepsis or anything like that. But still, she landed in the hospital. But she recovered. She was only in the hospital 3-4 days, recovered quickly. And when I saw her back in the office, her bilirubin was 2. It was way down. All the liver function tests are better. So we did the same thing, day 1, 1.1 milligram per meter squared with pegfilgrastim, day 2. Again, no day 8 treatment. And she did well. She had no problems with the therapy. When I saw her back for cycle 3, Neil, she had diuresed 44%. 5 pounds. She had no ascites. She had a normal bilirubin. Her liver function tests were much better. Neil, I've been doing it a long time. I think we've all had the experience, unfortunately, over and over and over again, that once that liver becomes so infiltrated that the bilirubin's up that much and you've got that significant drop in albumin and that significant ascites anisarca, I've never seen anybody come back from that, Neil. Never.
What happened imaging-wise?
I haven't imaged her because her CA2729 level's fallen like a rocket. And she's just so much better. She's eating. Her performance status went from kind of a 4 to a 1. And we're about 4 months into it now, so it's holding.
Are you planning on doing any imaging in the near future?
You know, she and I don't do a whole lot of imaging, Neil. I probably won't get an image on her because it wouldn't change my management at all, you know? I don't get tons of scans in the metastatic setting, to be honest with you. What I do is I don't change therapy based on numbers. I use the directionality of the 2729 to tell me whether I need a scan or not. So I won't change therapies based on a rising 2729, but I will go ahead and get a scan based on that. But otherwise, I don't do a ton of scans. So anyway, I am extremely impressed with the non-cross resistance of eribulin with everything else we have, is the bottom line, the ER positive. And, you know, now I'm really trying to understand where else I can use this in terms of where else am I going to see some home run deals. I mean, I've been talking to other doctors about this, and Joanne Blum has seen a couple of, you know, bringing people back from a near-death experience with ER positive liver disease. One of my other partners has seen real benefit in ER positive, HER2 positive disease. And I was talking to Matt Ellis over the weekend, and he had a BRCA1 germline mutation patient with lymph nodes and parenchymal lung who got a marvelous response to eribulin late line. So what I don't know yet from my own practice experience is what about the more classical triple negative that's not a BRCA1 germline mutation. The data, when you look at the subset data in the EMBRACE trial, the response rate in the triple negative was only 3.6%, and then the clinical benefit rate was about 11%, so pretty low. Yet, if you look at the forest plot with regard to overall survival, the point estimate is clearly in favor of the eribulin, and you know it's just as good in the triple negative. It overlaps one because it's a small subset, but it's every bit as good in the triple negative as it is in the ER positive. You know, and so I just don't have the experience, but I've got several. Now, I will tell you, I've got a patient right now I'm treating who's one of these sequencing patients, because we've got this small cohort of patients who have been totally gene-only sequenced, and I think she's a Claudin low. She's triple negative. She does not have the classic basal features, never benefited from AC, never benefited from platinum, not real fast growing, and she's got a CA2729, and I wonder, Neil, I wonder whether these cancers that make CA2729 may have some luminal properties. Now, Claudin low, you know, may not be a luminal cell, we don't really know. But when I see a lot of CA2729, I think, maybe we got some luminal properties going on here. Anyway, this gal, and she's triple negative, and she's got lung, liver, lymph nodes, very heavily pretreated, and her 2729 is falling on the eribulin right now. So I don't have enough information on her, but I'm cautiously optimistic on her. I don't know what it'll do in more classic basals, you know, where the taxanes don't work that great. You know, not that eribulin's a taxane, it's not a taxane, but the target is stopping the mitotic spindle and other microtubule assembly, you know, because it makes the tubulin subunits clog up and aggregate together into just globs. Anyway, very, very interesting new agent.
Why don't we pick one more case and go through it, whichever one you want?
Okay, so this one's interesting because I think it can be helpful and it leads into the controversy, the elephant in the room that I came away from ASCO with. So I have a young woman who's 36, mother of 4, who unfortunately presented with a locally advanced ERPR negative, HER2 FISH amplified, grade 3 ductal breast cancer, along with small volume biopsy proven liver metastases. And she declined alopecia inducing chemotherapy at presentation. And we treated her with vinorelbine, carboplatin, and trastuzumab. And she had a very slow decrease in her CA2729. It really was not one of those big time cytoreductive pro-apoptotic-like responses that we sometimes see with trastuzumab chemotherapy. But the 2729 was trickling down. And when you re-imaged her, she had very, very minor changes in her liver metastasis. I should say that the liver metastasis were found, she lives elsewhere in Texas, and the liver metastasis were found after her primary surgery. So she had already had a mastectomy by the time the liver metastases were found. So we don't have primary cancer to follow, just her liver metastasis. So it was kind of a really disappointing result because I felt that her ticket to getting durable, durable quality of life and disease control was if she had a great response, which is why I put in two chemotherapy drugs instead of one chemotherapy drug, you know, kind of doing a TCH-like thing, but she declined alopecia, so I put in vinorelbine, but it was a disappointing result for sure. So after about 6 months on that, Neil, her cancer started heading in the wrong direction. It started to very slowly, not real fast, but very slowly worsen. So, you know, we had other therapies, obviously, we could treat her with, but we happened to have a clinical trial going on, it's still open here at Baylor, which is trastuzumab in combination with BEZ-235, which is a Novartis compound, which blocks both mTOR and PI3 kinase, because we had sent her tissue off as part of that clinical trial to see if she would be eligible. And indeed, her cancer is devoid of P10. It's gone. Zero on the IHC. And when you lose your P10 totally, you've got, you know, real activation of your PI3 kinase. And so I thought she'd be an excellent candidate for the BEZ and trastuzumab combination. Well, this bad news all came right around Thanksgiving last year. And she was very, very depressed. And then it was the holidays, and she basically disappeared, Neil. She just didn't want to go on a phase one trial. She was just upset. So she came to see me in the March timeframe. We had been calling her and keeping in touch, etc. And she came to see me at the March timeframe. But unfortunately, Neil, she's walking through the door. She had been in bed with severe right upper quadrant pain, severe jaundice, and really in trouble. And her bilirubin was 4.4. And, you know, transaminase is way up, liver big. I mean, she's in trouble. So she had been off trastuzumab at this point for 5 or 6 months. So we started up the trastuzumab again, and I treated her with 3 lapatinib, 750, and treated her with capecitabine. I think it was 500 milligrams BID, 14.7. I was seeing her weekly at that time. It might have been 1,000 of the capecitabine in the morning and 500 in the afternoon, and it was a very substantially reduced dose. But I was seeing her weekly at that point, and she immediately started to respond. Her pain got better. Her 2729 was dropping like a rocket, and she just kept getting better, and the liver function tests get better, and the bilirubin normalized. So I kept going up on the doses. You know, I kept, you know, get her up to the lapatinib. She's on the 4 lapatinib now, 1,000. And she's on capecitabine. We got the 2 twice a day, 1,000 twice a day, 14.7. Keep the trastuzumab going. And great quality of life. Now, she does have this lapatinib rash. She's got the acneiform rash, a definite significant rash. It's on her face. It's on her chest and the upper arms. It's itchy. And we got her on tetracycline 250 BID. And we get it down, and we go down to 1 a day. Once it gets down, then it'll do pretty well for a while. Then it'll flare up again. So she'll have to go back up onto the tetracycline twice a day for a while. But she's got a great, great quality of life. I don't think I've imaged her yet, Neil. I'm going to. But she's really just doing great. So I'm hoping this is really going to end up being a home run for her. And if so, I'll just leave her on this indefinitely. And she's totally with me on that. And the beauty is she still hasn't lost her hair, which I'm so happy for her, you know. But anyway, she feels great. So I was really, really pleased with that particular patient.
I had this weird thought as you were describing this that maybe the entire response was related to the CAPE.
You know, CAPE is such a great drug. Capecitabine in HER2-positive patients as a single agent, you know, I guess what we can think about, Neil, we could look at the von Minkwitz trial, and there was about a 25% response rate. Remember, those are patients now who had been progressing on the trastuzumab and generally a taxane first line metastatic. And so they still had trastuzumab in their system. You know, that goes on for 2-3 months after you stop the trastuzumab, and they were randomizing the patients to capecitabine versus capecitabine trastuzumab. They published that in the JCO a year and a half ago or so. But those patients on the capecitabine alone arm still had that trastuzumab hanging around. So it's a little hard to isolate the capecitabine there. But that was about a 25% response rate, which doubled up to 50%. But the median PFS, as I'm recalling, wasn't that great, Neil. But yes, your point's well taken. But I'll tell you, capecitabine as an ER-negative drug, I'm not as impressed with it. In the liver, it's a great ER-positive drug. I'm not impressed with it, Neil. I'll give you an anecdote of a patient, 60 years old, T1C, N0, 1.8 centimeter node negative, presentation, lumpectomy radiation, ER strongly positive, PR negative, Ki-67 30%, and HER2 negative, treated her with 4 cycles of TC, then on to anastrozole, and she went 3 years on anastrozole and unfortunately recurred at 3 years with moderate volume liver and then bone. And when I redid the biopsy of the liver, the ER-PR were now negative. But I thought, well, I'm going to try my trick on her, my day 1, day 8 paclitaxel and the capecitabine that I told you about that works so well if you still have ER positive in the liver. And I was very encouraged because the 27-29 dropped like a rocket, 50% every cycle, every 3 weeks. It was dropping, dropping, dropping. So I thought, oh, great. She's on her way to another great response, durable. So after she had gotten, normal on the 27-29, the PET scan had normalized. We stopped the paclitaxel, kept going on the capecitabine, and 4 months later, 27-29 is worsening, PET scan's now positive. It wasn't the capecitabine at all. It was the paclitaxel. So unfortunately, the paclitaxel or taxane capecitabine trick, as I call it, in terms of that home run, durable benefit for patients, what I'm finding anecdotally in my practice trying to sort these phenotypes out into who can we really help is you have to have a retained ER. So I'm not terribly impressed with capecitabine as a single agent in ER-negative metastatic breast cancer. So I doubt it's the CAPE. And I think with this rash, with the erlotinib-type drugs, cetuximab-like drugs, when you see this rash, it really can kind of predict for response. So I think lapatinib is playing a role in this as well.
Yeah, I was just sort of thinking it because I've been thinking contrary to everything nowadays and just the fact that, we really have no idea. It could have been totally the lapatinib and capecitabine has no impact at all. We have no idea.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I don't know what's got into me recently, but I was just flashing on the fact that I was doing an interview at ASCO, and in the middle of the interview, I started to get this weird image that I was interviewing somebody about leaching.
Oh.
And that someday, we would view what we think today the same way we view about leaching.
Yeah, I've definitely thought about that as we get much more targeted and focused. I think we're going to look back on some of our, broad-based chemotherapy approaches. Although, no question, a lot of these chemotherapeutics that are very highly active are going to have very targeted mechanisms, and we're going to be able to deploy them to the right subset. There's no doubt in my mind on this. For example, Neil, and I want to tell you this, I was at a meeting over the weekend and Matt Ellis was there, and Matt has submitted a paper to a very high-profile journal, which I won't mention, and presumably it's going to get published. And then once it's published, I was going to recommend to you that you interview Matt because the Genome Center at WashU and with Matt, they totally sequenced 46 ER-positive primary breast cancers, and they found a lot of mutations, amplifications, translocations, et cetera. And Matt's genius is that he's able to bring his understanding of ER-positive biology into telling beautiful stories. And so he was showing me some of the data, and it is so cool. I mean, he really is bringing to light various mutations that not too long from now, we're going to be able to assay for these, and there may be implications like this patient here, you never want her off her anti-estrogen therapy. It's all about estrogen for her. She needs it forever, et cetera. And if she's got a different mutation, which I won't mention, I don't want to steal his thunder. If she's got this mutation over there, this is really bad, and she really isn't going to do well with endocrine therapy, and, this is a really bad cancer, et cetera. But he was telling me, for example, that in some of these ER positives, a lot of the abnormalities, they're finding some substantial abnormalities even further downstream than transcription factors, and a lot of amplicons in kinesins and mitotic spindle proteins. and all of these. And I said, oh, wow, you know, what are we going to do about that? You know, we don't have any target age. He goes, well, I bet you paclitaxel is going to work pretty well, you know. And so I think that some of it will end up looking like leaching for sure, but some of it, we were onto something. You know, it is true that the taxanes work well in ER-positive disease, but that's going to be an interesting interview, Neil, because there are going to be some possible clinical ideas that come out of his mutational analysis and the stories he's able to put together, which will have to be put to prospective randomized trials, but I think will be interesting for the clinician to kind of realize, oh, wait a second, there really are breast cancers that have mutations in them, that these cancers can never die, period. They will never die, and so therefore, we can suppress them, you know, et cetera. So anyway, he'll be a good person for you to talk to.
Yeah, I always like talking to Matt.